Welcome to Speak Up, the official podcast of Speech Pathology Australia. We bring you insightful conversations with leading professionals about key issues and innovations in speech pathology, all in a concise format that's perfect for your busy schedule. We aim to inform, inspire, and also engage. We love hearing from you, so please join the conversation on our social media platforms or email us with your thoughts and questions. And please subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues. Your support helps us grow and inform, inspire and engage others. Now, let's embark on today's conversation.
So hi, my name is Holly McAllister. I am a paediatric speech pathologist at Community Health in Young, New South Wales, and a member of the Speech Pathology Australia Early Career Reference Group. So I live and work on the lands of the Wiradjuri people. And I am here today with Michelle Bahari.
Thanks so much, Holly. My name is Michelle Bahari, obviously. I am a mental health occupational therapist. I live and work on the lands of the Bunurong people of the Eastern Kulin Nation. And I do pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. And it's great to be here with you.
Yes, and today, so we're going to talk about courageous conversations or brave conversations, however you want to refer to them. So I thought maybe just talking about some examples of what those might be, some of the things that my group in the ECRG talked about, conversations with clients and their families around, you know, diagnosis, assessment results, prognosis, that sort of thing. Conversations with managers or supervisors around, you know, salary, workload, that kind of thing. Are there any other examples, Michelle, that you've come across in your work?
Yeah, a lot. I think quite a number. So, you know, being able to give peers feedback one-on-one. So giving people feedback from things like how people work together, communication styles, through to things like, you know, physical discomfort or somebody who's gets a bit too close or, you know, just has different, different things that they might bring into the space that they may be unaware of. And sometimes the courageous conversations are not just with managers and more senior people, but also more junior people or a student or somebody who's maybe, in an allied health role or a different, you know, somebody that you don't have a direct sort of relationship with, but yet you have to find ways to work together. And there's some, you know, challenges or things that someone may not be aware of.
Yes. So, I think we were thinking of it from the perspective of being an early career professional, but there would be courageous conversations that everybody has, no matter their level of experience. There's always new experiences to have. Yeah. So, Michelle, I guess what is your reason for your passion behind this sort of topic?
Yeah, thanks so much for asking, Holly. So as a mental health occupational therapist, I'm also a trained psychotherapist, individual and group psychotherapist, as well as being a trained family therapist. I specialised in adolescent and youth mental health for many years, and I loved being a clinician. And I was very lucky to work in an organisation that really, for many years, valued learning. But as I stepped into a more of a supervision role and then a team leader and manager role, what I became increasingly aware of, particularly in other departments, so not so much in the department I was working within, was that there was a lot of behaviours that would have not been evidence-based. So even though we were aiming to be incredibly evidence-based in our clinical practice, I became increasingly aware of behaviours at all levels, from, you know, students and early career and more senior staff, you know, across the board, and thinking, gee, these behaviours are nothing like what you would expect, you know, in a professional environment. And of course, probably became more aware and more conscious of those as I was in a more senior role. And also felt like it was more impactful, you know, certainly on the people within my area or my department, and then becoming aware of how it was impacting within the clinical work as well. So what I saw, Holly, was that I saw increasingly toxic behaviours that I would say were very below the line. So behaviours that were psychologically unsafe, even potentially traumatising. I saw, put downs, gossip, dismissive sort of behaviour, talking badly about clients, very judgmental conversations about clients, about colleagues, nitpicking, very judgmental. And I found it really concerning because ultimately those things were very bad for culture, for workplace culture. And obviously from a neuroscientific perspective, if we're all seeing below the line behaviours, then what it's doing to us is it makes us all more fearful, less trusting of the environment, and we sort of armour up a lot more at work. And through armouring up, we're less open to learning, we're less likely to take risks, we have less, you know, our thinking ability is a bit more compromised because we're more in fear, more functioning from our brainstem and less from our executive brain, particularly our middle prefrontal cortex. So it means that we're not thinking as well, not as strategically, not as creatively, we're not thinking laterally, we're not relating as well, we're more guarded, more shut down, and less open to having those, you know, rich conversations of feedback and struggling with things together, but also less open to learning because we can get into the defensive space when we're functioning from our brainstem. So what I saw was not just things that I would say are unlawful at times, like I did see bullying. Was aware at times of, you know, hearing things that would be of that sort of nature or harassment or discrimination. But I was seeing lots of, you know, behaviours that were maybe not that far down below the line, but that still were below the line, that, you know, eye rolling and sniggering and excluding people and those sorts of things. And it really drew me to be, you know, here we were aiming to create such a significant relationship with our clients of psychological safety, and yet we were not providing that environment for our staff group, for our teams, for our one-on-one relationships. And it just, it made me feel really concerned about the impact that that then had, because I don't think it's good for well-being of the staff. I think that you'd have higher turnover in those departments and teams and services, but I think the clients miss out on people bringing the best service to work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, it's, you did mention this phrase while you were speaking, and we think about, or we had thought about, I think historically, safety in terms of physical safety in the workplace. But I think something that's become more commonly referred to or talked about is the concept of psychological safety in the workplace as well, and being able to, yeah, like you said, feel like you can approach people openly and discuss things that you have concerns about, or, yeah, if there are some of those really, as you said, below the line behaviours happening, which ultimately, yeah, would help support the clients as well if they have a clinician who is someone that feels happy and psychologically safe in their workplace, mm-hmm. for sure. So what are some of the things, Michelle, that you have come across that would help people to work above the line or to support themselves to be above the line in their workplace?
Yeah, so, you know, psychological safety is about, you know, being open to learning and to feel both supported and challenged. And so we often think about how do we create an environment where people feel both supported and challenged. You know, there's always going to be challenges in our work from our clients, from the types of presentations, from the fact that, you know, there's a finite health dollar. There are a lot of challenges. And as well as being an early career therapist, we're not just learning clinical skills, but we're building all of those skills of self-awareness and emotional intelligence and all the interpersonal skills and the professional skills and the self-care skills. We were on a very steep learning curve, I think, in those early career years. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it means that we need to be in an environment that is psychologically safe. But then coming back to your question about what we can do is we need to make sure that we allow psychological safety in our own heads.
Yes.
And so, you know, many of us are very self-critical. We can judge ourselves really harshly. We can be very tough on ourselves. I absolutely used to be like that. I was horrible to myself. I would be ferocious.
I can certainly put my hand up and say that that is sometimes me as well, getting better, but sometimes it slips back into those sorts of patterns.
Yeah. And so, you know, so we want we want an environment, and we deserve, and from a legislative framework, we require an environment that's not just physically safe. We also require an environment that is psychologically safe. That is paramount. But I think we also need to make sure that we create that in our head, and that we ensure as much as possible that we allow ourselves to be learners, because if we get caught up in thinking that we need to be perfect or allow perfectionism to run rife with us, we actually stop ourselves from being learners, and we discourage ourselves from taking risks and thinking creatively, and we end up wiring our brain inadvertently more towards the lower parts of our brain, our brainstem, and less towards the higher parts of our brain, which support that higher cognitive functions, but also that capacity to learn and relate to others, which is clearly really paramount.
Yes. So you might say that some of the courageous conversations we have to have with ourselves,
exactly.
to try and reflect on those behaviours that might be unconscious but might be really impacting ourselves, our work and our non-work life as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. So those conversations might involve, courageous conversations with ourselves might involve, it's okay that I'm a learner.
Yeah.
It's okay not to know everything. It's okay that there are some areas where I may know very little. It's okay to ask questions. It's okay to, you know, look around the room and figure out who is safe to ask, who is psychologically safe. It's okay to, aim in some areas for good enough and some areas to aim really high at practice excellence. And ultimately that's where we want to go in all areas, to practice excellence. But that's not perfect. No one is ever perfect. We never get to perfect. And if we do, then we're deluded or misguided, because we need, you know, we're in professions that we need to keep growing and developing. If you're doing the same thing you were doing 5 years ago, we're going backwards.
Mm.
And what does that actually ultimately mean? We have to set ourselves up for success from the beginning of our career, to realize that we are lifelong learners, and that what new graduates and early career therapists have is they have that recency of training, that recency of knowledge, that we're, you know, further down the pathway are a lot further away from. And that freshness and that recency of training is invaluable. So rather than thinking, I've got nothing to, what do I know as an early career therapist? No, not at all. You have a lot that those of us who are more experienced don't have. As an OT, I always used to say this: the model of human occupation came in as a very big major theoretical underpinning for OT practice. It really progressed a lot of things that had been developed earlier, but it was quite significant. And I always used to say to people when I met them, I'm a pre-Moho trained OT, because I wanted to, even though I had more experience than some of the people I was relating to, I was trying to always amplify that they had expertise that I didn't have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I really want your, you know, your audience and your early career therapists to really honor and value and have a courageous conversation with themselves about what they are actually bringing to the table that people who have been around for a long time don't have as much of. Yeah. And at the same time to honor that with experience comes other forms of knowing and wisdom, and that, you know, ideally teams and workplaces operate well with having all of that combined together.
Yeah. I have heard, I unfortunately haven't had the chance to supervise any students myself yet, but I have heard from others who have taken students on placement that one of the benefits for the supervising clinician is that sharing of knowledge and the new evidence and everything that the students are taught while they're studying. Like, they get to really find out about what all of the new information is, yeah, mm-hmm. and the new approaches.
So that's a beautiful thing, isn't
yeah.
it, for our students and our early career therapists to be the, you know, the deliverers of new research and knowledge. And so, you know, this, and to, in order to do that, it's then having the courage to share that knowledge with us.
Yes.
And it is also up to us to be interested and to ask about those things. But it is something that we really want to cultivate, and we can't do it, you know, experienced people can't do it without the participation of those who bring that knowledge.
Yeah,
I think the other courageous, there's lots of courageous conversations, but you know, as I've mentioned, not to be perfect and to moderate our expectations of self, that, you know, we want to be more than good enough, but in some areas maybe good enough's okay as the first port of call to aim for, and in some areas we want to really start diving towards practice excellence, but that does take time. And then, you know, the other sort of courageous conversations are, you know, not to be robots. I'm not a robot. I'm human, and humans need compassion and care. So, you know, it's also that we're working in an industry where there's a high degree of emotional wear and tear, high degree of mental wear and tear, and that can impact our mental health and our well-being. And we do need more sophisticated skills in looking after ourselves. So that's the other courageous conversation I think we need to have with ourselves, is giving ourselves permission to nurture ourselves, because that is part of the platform to bring out the best in ourselves, to help us thrive, so that we are strategic in how we build our skill base, but also our self-care base, so that we can actually function optimally. And that's what's really needed.
Yeah. Self-care is another thing that has been a lot more talked about over the last however many years. It seems very recent still. What are some of the ways that you have come across that aren't necessarily, because a lot of the discussions around self-care can be, you know, buying things to make yourself feel better and that sort of thing. But what, when you get down to the sort of the bare bones of self-care, what would you describe that as?
Mm. If you can imagine a bit of a seesaw, and on one of the sides of the seesaw are all our demands, so our professional demands and our personal demands, and on the opposite side of the seesaw is our energy, and I'm talking about our physical energy, but also our mental energy, emotional energy, and even spiritual or soulful energy, if that's important for you. And I think, to me, really deep self-care is when we've got more energy, we make sure we look after ourselves in ways that give us more energy than is required by our demands.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, that's when we thrive, because then we've got the energy, or the bandwidth, I would say, to do the things in life that we want to do, not just the things that we have to do. And that means we've got the energy to have fun and go out into nature and hang out with other people and do all the things that we, you know, whatever it is for each of you, that you can deeply nurture yourself. in ways that actually boost your energy. So it's not just, retail therapy might give us a little bit of a hit of short-term dopamine, but I really wonder about how sustainable that is and how nurturing it is, and whether there are other ways that really deeply, you know, sort of replenish our energy. I'm going to come back and talk about the energy in a minute. But so with the demands, there are professional demands, there are personal demands, there are reasonable demands and unreasonable demands. So maybe some of, you know, when we strive for perfection, and maybe that's where we put unreasonable demands on ourselves. So maybe one of the ways we can reduce some of our demands is by thinking about the unreasonable demands we may place on ourselves personally and professionally. And I think that's, you know, sometimes we do have to slightly reset our standards. And I don't mean have poor standards, but, you know, just make sure that we're not aiming for something that is impossible.
And often more realistic standards.
More realistic. And the best litmus test for me of that is thinking about, would you expect this of someone else? Because often there's a double standard that we have, you know, that if, you know, we go to someone's house and the house is not perfectly tidy, we think, oh, that's fine, they're busy, but our house has to be perfect. You know what I mean? I'm not saying that that is the, but whatever it is, similar to that. And I'm not saying that we get to sloppy or dirty or, you know, there's a good enough and then there's, you know, not good. I'm not talking about going to that bad level, but and so I think, you know, they're the things that we need to do. We need to moderate some of those demands. Some of the demands are put on us by society, some of us by the workplace. Some are reasonable, some are unreasonable. Some of those, you know, maybe some people I hear say about the NDIS that some of the standards are unreasonable. Some of, you know, there can be things that happen that are unreasonable. I'm not certainly saying that everything that happens outside is reasonable. I think that there are some unreasonable demands, but the things that we can most quickly change are the unreasonable demands that we are placing on ourselves. So that already frees up some of our energy. And to me, that's some of the really critical self-care that we can do, is stop being unreasonable towards ourselves. And then on the other side of the seesaw, it's building up our energy. So what are little things that we can do each day that help build our physical, our mental, our emotional and spiritual energy? And what things can we do less of that reduce our energy? So incessant self-criticism. And what I noticed in myself is that when I was in a shame storm, when I'd be criticizing and judging myself really badly, it just flattened my energy, just gutted my energy. And I thought, well, that's not really helping me learn. That's not helping me be strategic about the situation that I was judging myself about. It was actually undermining my capacity to do something better or to learn or develop further. And so there are things that we can do to boost up our energy. So, you know, hanging out with friends, or, you know, for me, it's going to nature or exercise or meditation or mindfulness, or, you know, watching something that makes me laugh. I mean, there are, you know, music is, you know, beautiful for our energy. So doing those things, making sure that we do enough of them each day in ways that really, you know, that is deeply nourishing, and reducing the things that we do that are actually draining of energy. So I like to be well informed, but I noticed that when I watch news, I'm more energy drained than when I read a newspaper. So I would read a newspaper online in preference to the sort of, you know, sometimes the way that the news is communicated on the TV can be a very full on and, you know, almost, you know, all the bad news stories, and you're a bit subject to it, you know, whereas when you read, it's sort of has a different, you know, yes, energy, if you know what I mean. So that's just one example. And that may, I'm not saying that's true for everyone that's listening to this by any means. Please don't think that what I'm suggesting to you is a recipe or prescription for you, but I'm inviting you to think about your own energy and how it fluctuates according to the things that you do. That was just an example for me. So, yeah, that to me is really deep self-care, Holly. Nice. Yeah.
Slightly related to that, I think, and you had mentioned it before, but I wanted to come back to it, is the concept of emotional intelligence as well. What can you tell us about that?
So this is an area I'm really passionate about, and partly why I'm so passionate about things like this and the neurosciences and psychological safety, those areas, is because they're so well evidenced. So there's so much research about that, and that it also really concurs with my anecdotal experience throughout my career and the, you know, hundreds, thousands of conversations that I've had over the years with so many. So emotional intelligence, very simply, is really having a good capacity to be aware of, to be able to make sense of and influence our own emotions and how we show up in relationship with others, and being aware of others' emotions and being a positive influence in overall. I mean, not that we don't have to strive for perfection again, but that we, you know, that we are a good influence in the workplace, not coming in every day in bad moods and, you know, bringing morale down. And particularly about 15 years ago, I did the Genos model of emotional intelligence training. Genos International is an Australian-based model, and it's quite unique in that it was one of, I think, the first internationally recognized model of emotional intelligence, where all their research was based on workplace. So a lot of the previous models of EI were not specific to workplace environments. So a lot of the skills looked more broadly at the sort of skills of EI that you might need for personal relationships and at in home environment. And not to say that there aren't overlaps, there are significant overlaps between those areas, but I really loved that the research was all done on workplaces and really investigating what skills of EI do we need to in order to function optimally in the workplace. And so the seven, would you like me to share a bit about just quickly the seven skills?
Yeah, that would be fantastic.
Yeah. You all have them and you all know them. The hard thing is that we don't have labels for them. And as soon as we say the labels, you'll go, oh yeah, I do that here. Yeah. I do that there. That's all very familiar. So the first one is emotional awareness, which is just being aware of, making sense of our own emotions. The second one is for others. So it's the way we are aware of others' emotions, that we can sense and, you know, recognize through body language and words and communication where other people are coming from and make sense of that. The third area of emotional intelligence is emotional expression. So it's our ability to put into words how we're feeling and what's happening for us. The fourth area is emotional reasoning, so how we make decisions about emotions, how we use emotional material as data, not to let emotions run everything, but also how not to exclude emotions as part of our decision-making process. The fifth skill is self-management. So it's how we are a positive influence to ourselves. So we might have had a fight with somebody before we get to work in the morning, and it's the skill of being able to shift gears so that we can not then take that fight out on our colleagues or our clients, that we actually can, you know, can shift gears, park things and come back to them. The sixth skill is positive influence of others. So it's the way in which we show up, you know, in a hopeful, optimistic space. Doesn't mean toxic positivity, doesn't mean that we deny suffering or pain or things like that, of course, but we also overall try and aim that we bring more positive than negative into our relationships. And the seventh one you would know as self-regulation. So it's the way in which we influence and manage our strong emotions, particularly when we're triggered, so that we, and we're not damaging to others. And emotionally intelligence, I really appreciate you asking me about this, because I know you'll want to come back to the courageous conversations. And
I think it all does link in, though.
All does link in, and it links in because those skills are how we operationalize psychological safety. So when people are optimal in emotional intelligence, they are actually ideal employees in terms of being able to participate in building a psychologically safe environment. And those skills are really foundational in being able to have courageous conversations, because they're the skills of being aware of myself, being aware of the other, being able to put into words complex. So rather than saying, I'm angry with you, being able to say, you know, and express the anger inappropriately, I'm able to say, reflect on, yes, yesterday I felt angry, and to be able to say it in a calm, centered state. Yeah, yesterday, I feel like we had a bit of a misunderstanding. Can we speak about that? You know, so that we can have that's emotional expression, when we can put into words complex things and have conversations. So absolutely, all those EI skills and an awareness of those really provide the foundation for courageous conversations.
Absolutely. So you had talked about before, in another time and another place, that the emotional self-management element or skill of emotional intelligence was more of a proactive, preventative type of skill, and then the self-regulation was a first aid sort of skill when it comes to managing our emotions and learning from our emotions. How would you describe the way that both of them sort of help contribute to courageous conversations?
It's a brilliant question that you are asking, and thank you for asking it, because it actually really helps me identify the differences between those two skills, which I know Genos has struggled a little bit, to be honest, around. I'll talk you through an example without going into detail. But if I, for example, wanted to have a courageous conversation with you today, self-management, the fifth skill, positive self-management, is about thinking, I'm going to have that skill, I want to have that conversation with Holly today. What can I do in a proactive way to make sure that I am in a calm, relaxed, grounded space with lots of bandwidth? So if I was going to do something, planning to do something proactive future, something that was emotionally demanding, and I thought, oh, that might be an emotionally demanding conversation, I would be thinking of, what can I do in the 24 hours leading up to that conversation to boost my emotional well-being? And I might decide, I might reduce my, not go out the night before, or not see too many people socially, or not expose myself to something that's upsetting, like the news or something. Just for a little short time, just so that I'm in the right place and I've got good bandwidth to have that conversation. So it's been quite intentional, and appreciating that courageous conversations do draw on our emotional energy. Mm-hmm. And that if I come to that well grounded in good energy, I'm optimizing my ability to engage in that conversation as well as I can. In the middle of the conversation, if someone says something that triggers me and my brainstem starts, or my limbic system or brainstem start hijacking me, the seventh skill, is about how do I manage myself in that moment. So it's a more reactive sort of skill. It's like, what do I do now? It's not future focused. It's really in this moment. And that is one of the skills, I think, that is quite undeveloped in many of us for a lot of reasons. And I think many of us get into a defensive mode because somehow we've bought this idea, and I include myself in this. I mean, I think, you know, I think it's something many of us struggle with. Doesn't mean we're defensive outwardly, but we can feel defensive inside because somehow we've internalized the idea that we should be perfect.
I think it's also the possibility as well that you have, you know, psyched yourself up to have this courageous conversation, and that you have been open with whoever it is that you're having this conversation with. If they don't react in the way that you expect as well, then, yeah, like you said, our limbic system starts to take over.
And then we don't want to react to those things. We actually want again to be thinking about what do I want the outcome of this to be. So we want to shift gears and become future focused and, you know, harness ourselves and, you know, say something like, is it okay if we pause this conversation? My brain stem's hijacking me and I'm feeling like I'm not able to think as clearly and I don't want to be reactive or, you know, like, I think that's okay, not to use it in a manipulative way, but to say, you know, this is where I'm at the moment, because that is the truth. You know, if we pretend in a way that we're always functioning optimally from our executive brain, but that's not the truth or the case. And I think that one of the things that can help in a team environment is, you know, being able to be more open with one another about saying, you know, I just need a bit of time out at this moment because I'm, you know, and it might just involve a 2-minute walk outside, a bit of fresh air, and, you know, that we can get back into that executive brain functioning. And so it's having the skills of being aware of when it's happening and knowing what can, you know, work quickly so that we're, you know, it might be just going get a glass of water and we can, you know, find a way back to that conversation. I'm not talking about delaying it for a month or anything like that. Yeah. But it is, you know, it is, it's quite a skill in the moment, in those heated moments when things are really uncomfortable, to actually make a choice and have the skill and the wherewithal to be aware of how to navigate in a strategic and caring and compassionate way for self and other in those situations.
Excellent. Yeah, I was just reflecting on my own sort of experiences with that, and I was very lucky to have a colleague of mine who is also an OT, or a former colleague now, but she and I, we were quite open with each other about how we were coping with things. If we needed to take a break, we'd go for a walk around the block and that kind of thing. We did have a lot of clients that we shared, that we worked with together. So being able to debrief as well with her about what happened in their sessions and that sort of thing too was so valuable for, yeah, having that psychologically safe sort of person as well as workplace.
Mm.
Yeah. I also was thinking about, in your experience, Michelle, how has, or from your perspective, how has sort of the nature of this topic, courageous conversations, evolved?
Mm-hmm. I think specifically, I think that over the last, say, 30, 40 years, what I've seen is that there's been a huge shift in society of being able to talk much more directly in the here and now about relationships and about how we get on, which means that we've got more awareness and more language, and partly what I just said about some of those EI skills.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, we have some incredible research from in the area of psychological safety, and also work with people like I was referring to, you know, Dr. Daniel Siegel, who I'm sure many of your pediatric speech pathologists would be very aware of, and here's a whole area of interpersonal neurobiology.
Absolutely.
Understanding the, you know, the way that interpersonal relationships impact our brain and our brain functioning. And so, you know, I love that we are all getting better at, you know, thinking in a more sophisticated way about these things. And then probably, you know, social media, there's some good things about social media and maybe some not good things about it, but it has given us more spaciousness, I think, and more of an opportunity to interact with a wide range of people and learn from each other about how we can communicate. And I think mostly that's been a good thing. I think sometimes it can be used in negative ways as well. So there is a caution there. But so I think all of those things have influenced how we have courageous conversations. I don't think it's courageous to have a conversation to hide behind a keyboard. So, you know, that's what I'm particularly referring to. I think it's courageous to have a conversation in person with somebody on Zoom, with somebody where we can look at each other, you know, eye to eye and, you know, really engage in a rich human to human conversation. I think the other thing that's changed is that we used to have, you know, and it still affects us, you know, very old-fashioned, autocratic, command and control types of ideas around hierarchy and how things should happen. And I think ultimately we're going to move towards, hopefully, a flipped hierarchy where we see our clients and consumers and community at the top, our frontline staff, who are there to support them next, and then team leaders and supervisors next, and then managers and, you know, the executives and board and so on at the bottom, all supporting the clients. And I think we are making, we haven't made that shift yet, but that's probably where we're heading. And so what does that then mean is that accountability conversations are not just us being accountable to someone more senior than us, but actually, and this is part of why I said what I did at the beginning, you know, we're accountable to one another, we're accountable to our students, we're accountable to our clients, we're accountable to our seniors, and our seniors are accountable to us. So I think courageous conversations used to be more in that hierarchical space, but I actually think that how it's also evolved is that we've learned that we need to be courageous in a much more holistic way internally with ourselves and in all of those other types of relationships and dynamics.
Absolutely. So we have talked a bit about some of the, I guess, underlying skills that can help us to have courageous conversations, and there are obviously a lot of positive outcomes of that, you know, when we start to think about our emotional intelligence and developing those skills and developing a psychologically safe place in our own minds and within our workplaces. What would you say to someone who is sort of trying to balance the need for having a courageous conversation, no matter what it could be about or who it could be with, versus the potential negative outcomes of having that conversation?
So I think it's a really good, you know, question. And in fact, you know, this morning I was contacted by an executive leadership team to do some work on exactly this, on courageous conversations. And, you know, one of the things that this person was talking about was how they prioritized kindness over having courageous conversations. And that there is, so, you know, that's one thing that can happen.
Interesting.
You know, we can be, you know, we come into this sector with a lot of desire to be kind and compassionate, and it can be unbalanced when we can progress that idea at the expense of accountability and growth and learning. And so I think it's really important that we sort of look at those sort of costs, you know, why do we need to have courageous conversations, but also recognize that there are some costs to have those conversations. So maybe it would be helpful if I unpacked those.
Yeah, yeah. I was just thinking of the example that you gave. It's sort of not wanting to rock the boat or wanting to have that level of maybe to the point of being toxic positivity, yeah, without acknowledging that sometimes people might have to say things that you don't necessarily want to hear.
Yeah. So I think there are the risks. Let me just spare a couple of things I'd like to speak to here. So one of them is the risks of courageous conversations. I think the things that consistently hold people back are risks of damaging relationships. And it absolutely happens. Even when it's delivered really well, there are times, you know, I'm not trying to be negative here, but I think that the risk is real. I think there is a real risk that even if you have sophisticated skills in courageous conversations and giving feedback kindly and gently, sometimes it's not always going to be well received. So I just want to be real about that. I think that's why sometimes we shy away from it, because we may have had that experience before or seen others have that experience, you know, personally or professionally. And so there, we do know that that is a risk. There's no question. We want to minimize the risk, and we don't want risks to run everything, but there is that risk. We also know that there's the risk of being misunderstood. So, you know, when whatever we might convey to another person or what they might convey to us might be misunderstood. So even though the point of a courageous conversation is to increase understanding, that does not always happen. And I think what can get in the way, obviously, is when those conversations are triggering, and when we try from a triggered state to keep talking, even though we actually don't have the mental bandwidth to take anything, we don't have the mental bandwidth to see something from another person's perspective, because when we're functioning more from our limbic system and particularly brainstem, that capacity to that's comes from our executive brain or middle prefrontal cortex, the capacity to really see things from another's perspective is greatly diminished. Another risk, of course, that I think we haven't yet mentioned at all, is that some people experience learning trauma. And learning trauma comes from the times in which we haven't known what we didn't know, and we're all in that in loads of ways. We don't know what we don't know. And there are, luckily, millions of things we don't have to know in life. You know, I'm grateful that, people, you know, understand electricity and, you know, make sure that we've got electricity coming to our house every day, and someone else understands, you know, the traffic light system, and someone else understands how to have water in coming out of our taps. So there are lots of the internet, so many things that I can trust other people. But then there are things in my realm that I still don't know as well. Mm. So, you know, part of what I need to do is to be open to that. But it's hard when we've experienced learning trauma, when we've been shamed and humiliated, when someone has brought to our attention the fact we didn't know something, and they delivered it in a punitive, negative, judgmental, traumatizing way. And that is, again, one of the risks, I think, of courageous conversations, and part of what holds us back at times. We don't want to add to learning trauma. And of course, I have mentioned emotional triggers and defensiveness, that, you know, they are some of the risks. So I don't think any of those risks, of course, should stop us from having courageous conversations, but they are some of the reasons why we, you know, understandably struggle to do.
Yeah. So, yes, as you said, there are understandably potential risks and experiences that we bring to the table, which might amplify those risks for us as well. But what would be some of the benefits of having a courageous conversation?
Yeah, I think the benefits so far outweigh risk. So thank you for asking that. Number one is necessity. We all have things that we don't know that we don't know. And if we don't have, you know, bring to other people's attention certain things, they won't know, which means that they don't know that you need to share something, that you've got a question about something, that you want to give them feedback, pointing something out to them that might be new. So it's absolutely a necessity. And if we don't do that, we are absolutely robbing everyone of the benefits of that. When I published my book, Leading Above the Line, and I had my book launch, I asked a number of people to speak about being an above-the-line leader. And one of them was Dr. Donovan Moncur, who's a child and adolescent psychiatrist. And I asked him to speak because I knew one of the prevailing things about his team, which I'd had the privilege of providing some ongoing development programs for over many years, was that he had the attitude that he had to learn from everybody, that everybody had information, perspective, knowledge, and questions that he wouldn't have, and that he had to create an environment where everyone would feel comfortable to share and to be courageous. And that is, like, obviously a very humble position to take. He also valued his own strengths in that, but I think it just shines a light on how it's necessary to be courageous in our conversations and to share perspectives or questions or, you know, either that we don't know something or that someone else might not know something and work through those things together.
Mm-hmm.
Courageous conversations are necessary for us to grow. You know, there are even the things that you mentioned earlier about, you know, say with clients having to give a, you know, difficult diagnosis or having to work through those things. It doesn't help to withhold. Unfortunately, the only, you know, it's hard. I'm not saying it's not really super hard, but if we don't have those courageous conversations, we're actually getting in the way of that person working through their responses and ultimately growing and adapting to a, you know, to a clearer landscape. And even though it's hard, it's better to know than not to not know, because then we know, you know, what we are dealing with as, you know, as parents and families, and also as clinicians. If our colleagues don't realize that we don't know certain things or that we have insights that they may not have, we're risking everyone from you know, learning and growing.
Yeah.
I think the other benefits of having brave conversations is that ultimately, most of the time, it is really relationship building. You know, to being able to have a difficult conversation afterwards, we can acknowledge, gee, that was a hard conversation, but good on us. You know, we navigated that and we may have both taken away new learning from that, and we didn't let the discomfort damage our relationship. I think that's really something to celebrate.
Absolutely. I think from my experience, there, even if it, you know, doesn't go exactly the way that you imagine, there is such a feeling of relief once you've gone over that hurdle.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a huge relief. So it is, it's like climbing a mountain and getting up to the top and thinking, you know, we're doing well here. And the last thing is, as an organization, a team, a service, we by not having difficult conversations, we're actually robbing moments of growth, moments of development, moments of progress. And I think that's all super, super important.
Absolutely. So, Michelle, do you have any last words of advice for everyone listening around having courageous conversations?
Yeah, I'd love to share some of the tips that I have. So one is just to take small steps, you know, like to not think you've got to be brilliant at courageous conversations tomorrow. But, you know, it might be that if you could think that there were 20 little steps to get better at courageous conversations, what would that look like? And some of it might be just talking to people that you'd normally not talk to, or going up and initiating conversations with people, or asking questions. Do you know what I mean? So making some little steps along the way that help build your muscle of doing things that are a little bit uncomfortable.
Yep.
The next thing is, which builds on this, which is build relationships. You know, get to know the people that you want to give feedback to or have those conversations with, and understand how they operate. Maybe even at times, you know, if you want to have a difficult conversation, maybe with a manager, ask them about how, you know, they like to give feedback. You know, have a two-way conversation about feedback, and, you know, what they think about when they're giving someone else feedback, and how, what makes them feel comfortable to accept feedback. I like sort of laying all sorts of seeds along the way to make it easier to go there for the future. So if I wanted to, for example, have a conversation about how I was managing stress, I might plant seeds initially to ask my manager, you know, I want to talk generally about how everyone copes with stress. Sometimes it gets stressful. And I might have a general conversation first, suss it out, and then maybe have a further conversation at another point once I've digested that, and think about, well, how can I raise that now, given that, is that how that person thinks about it? Does that make sense? So to plant seeds. I think invite and welcome feedback for yourself. So if you are inviting others to give you feedback, it shows that you are a feedback type of person, or a courageous conversation person. They're two ways. So, you know, welcome feedback, and that really builds trust and psychological safety, which is so foundational for this.
Mm-hmm.
Be really aware of not judging or focusing on what you don't want. So often when people have courageous conversations, usually people they might judge in their heads but are not judging out there. But often what people do is say, I don't want this, or I don't like that, or speak very much to the negative. And I think, I'm not saying that that's bad, but I think the best thing we can do is say what we do want, and even speak to the skills that we want to develop, or the insights or the understanding that we want. So I'll give you a really good example. You know, if someone says, oh, gee, I don't like how that person spoke to me, they're rude. So rude is judging them, right? So you don't want to say, you were rude to me. You could say, I don't like how you spoke to me. Again, but that's negative, isn't it?
More likely to put them on the defensive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then we think about, what do we want? Well, we want to have a good relationship. So if I say, I want to have us to have a great relationship, I want us to work really well together, sometimes when we speak to each other, I feel like, you know, it doesn't align with that. And what I'd really like to say, you know, so an example of that is, I felt a bit dismissed in that last conversation. So it's not that I don't mention that, but I put it in the context of what I do want or what I'm looking for. So that's, you know, sometimes it's spending the time to think about not just what I don't want, but what I do want. And the other thing that I think is really helpful is to ask those who you observe at being good at courageous conversations, what do they do? How do they do it? Yeah. So ask, if you want to give your manager courageous, you know, to have a courageous conversation with them, ask, how do they have courageous conversations when they need to? How do they give their manager feedback when they need to, or other staff? Do they have a strategy? Do they have a step-by-step process? you can learn a lot from that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think my takeaway is probably remembering to break it down into those smaller steps. We're not expecting to be brilliant at it in the next 24 hours. We don't expect it of our clients, so why should we expect it of ourselves? But yeah, thank you so much, Michelle, for joining me today to talk about courageous conversations. This has been wonderful.
Thanks, Holly. I've really enjoyed our conversation, and I do want to acknowledge that courageous conversations are probably one of the skill sets at work that is one of the hardest. Mm. And so it's a lifelong journey. Don't feel like you've got to master it all today. But it is something I think we just need to keep coming back to. And it does change depending on our role and, you know, where we're up to and what our professional demands are, and see it as a lifelong skill set that we can give ourselves permission to keep growing with.
Absolutely.
We hope you've enjoyed this week's conversation. Please subscribe to the podcast and share with your colleagues and friends. You can also visit us at speechpathologyaustralia.org.au. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.